Judith Copeland was the first person to be tried for espionage during the Cold War, but much controversy surrounds the case as to her guilt or innocence, as well as the sometimes contending issues, even in our own time, of individual rights versus national security. Our special guests this week, Marcia and Tom Mitchell, address these topics in their discussion of the Copeland case. Marcia Mitchell is former senior manager for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Tom Mitchell, a former counterintelligence FBI agent, worked on the Rosenberg spy case. Both are authors of The Spy Who Seduced America, Lies and Betrayal in the Heat of the Cold War, The Judith Copeland Story. Their remarks were recorded at Station WNYE in New York City.
It is shortly after 5:30, the evening of March 4, 1949.
The stalker's eyes, frosty, intense, never left the woman. His brain, carefully trained for the process, recorded her every step, her every movement and gesture. He moved expertly through the early evening crowd in Manhattan's Pennsylvania Station. If the object of his pursuit was aware of the danger the stalker presented, she did not show it in her expression, which remained calm and confident, but her movements suggested that she at least suspected his presence. At first glance, nothing about the attractive young woman who'd stepped off the afternoon train from Washington would seem unusual, but only at first glance. Wearing a fitted black wool coat and a black beret cocked fashionably over her left brow, she moved briskly, like a mechanical doll with a short circuit, first going one direction and then another, up one flight of stairs and down a different flight, moving forward, turning, retracing her steps. A casual observer might have conjectured that the woman was lost or bewildered by the 5:30 crunch of commuters rushing by. But the self-assured way in which she walked, in whichever direction, belied that conclusion. She did, however, seem to be looking for someone in the crowd, even as she paged through a magazine at a newsstand. Finally, after a last glance over her shoulder, she left the station and went out into the chilly Manhattan night, using the busy 34th Street exit. Now the stalker was joined by others.
At New York City's Foley Square headquarters of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Al Belmont, the assistant special agent in charge, was monitoring an extensive surveillance operation. Remarkably, Ed Scheidt, special agent in charge of the New York City FBI office, and Robert Granville, chief of the espionage section, were both on the street, supported by 24 agents. It was an extraordinary level of bureau activity, even for New York. In Washington, J. Edgar Hoover was in his office, waiting. When he received word, he would place a call to President Harry Truman. The chief of the world's top intelligence agency waited now in the smaller of his two private offices, one I knew well. A single ACA-bound folder rested on his highly polished desk. The file was new, numbered 65-58365. The first two numerals identified the nature of the case, espionage.
At 10 minutes after 6 o'clock, 40 minutes after her arrival in Manhattan, the young woman in black boarded a crowded 8th Avenue northbound train, clutching a large leather handbag to her chest, shoving into standing space where she remained until many blocks later she found a seat. At the 181st Street station, she left the train, moving along with the crowd toward the exit. Suddenly, she reversed her direction and walked, alone, toward the northernmost exit, one leading to 184th Street. Later, she would meet a short, stocky, fair-haired man who had his own followers. But they did not stay together. They were meeting, separating, jumping off and on buses and commuter trains, at times losing their pursuers through clever, evasive tactics. The chase that so interested Mr. Truman and Mr. Hoover in Washington continued on in America's sweetheart city, in wild, vibrant Manhattan. By now, it had gone from Penn Station to Uptown, Uptown to Midtown, Downtown, Crosstown to Times Square, through the chilly, neon-lit night. Now, espionage chief Granville was thinking about this city, about perhaps losing the suspects altogether in its labyrinthine possibilities. He determined that if the two were found again tonight, together, he would arrest them. There would be no waiting to make certain that documents had changed hands. There was no worry about not having an arrest warrant. After all, Granville assured himself, the law provided for an arrest without warrant under these circumstances. At that very moment, the news blasted from his police radio. The subjects had been spotted, together, downtown on 15th Street and 3rd Avenue.
"Let's go," Granville yelled to his partner, shoving the accelerator onto the floor and turning on the siren. With the wail of the siren and the high-pitched squeal of the car's noisy fan belt, a giveaway trademark of the Bureau's black Fords, they raced downtown from Broadway and 180th Street. Careening onto 14th Street, the siren was silenced by design and the car slowed by traffic. The woman in black and the fair-haired man stood watching, rooted to the sidewalk, as Granville whirled the car around a post supporting the 3rd Avenue L and brought it to a screeching halt at the curb. He leaped from the car and grabbed Judith Copeland's arm. "FBI, I'm Special Agent Robert Granville. You're under arrest," he told her.
It is the same evening after 9 o'clock.
Bureau headquarters occupied several floors in the federal courthouse building at Foley Square. It was to the 6th floor office that Judith Copeland, a beautiful 27-year-old political analyst of the U.S. Department of Justice in Washington, was taken immediately following her arrest. The man arrested with her, Valentin Kubichev, an engineer with the Soviet UN delegation, was taken to an office down the hall. In yet another office, Granville watched as FBI agent Scotty Miller dropped the contents of Judith's purse on the table. A cursory examination horrified them. What they had expected to find in the Russian had never left her possession. Nothing had passed from the woman to the Russian. It was all still there, and what was there would be feverishly debated for years. Was it evidence of intent to betray, or was it something else?
After two false starts, shortly before noon on March 5th, the young woman and the Russian engineer were indicted on espionage charges. Thus began what surely must be the most controversial, convoluted, and bizarre legal case in the history of American jurisprudence. It enchanted the entire country and focused national attention on key issues concerning individual rights in America versus national security. The public, the press, and the Congress all reacted immediately to the startling fact of a trusted government employee, one with access to FBI files, being arrested for conspiracy to commit espionage, for giving or intending to give this country's secrets to the Soviets. Many disbelieved. This was a young woman from a notably patriotic family, an honor graduate of Barnard College, a woman with an impeccable history as student, citizen, and worker. They wondered, could this be a case of madness born of the nationwide fear of communism, of the red-hating excesses of the time? Others did believe and were outraged. The woman should be tried immediately and, said some, executed without delay. The press went wild, loving the story. Judith's photographs were everywhere. There was a prevailing fear of Russia and the atomic bomb at the time of Judith's arrest. People were building bomb shelters, terrified by the possibility of a Soviet nuclear attack. It's important to note that the Soviets were spying and they were working on the bomb. But exaggerated fears were leading to exaggerated behaviors. Already simmering on the nation's stove were the ingredients that would lead, a year later, to the controversial McCarthy interrogations.
Congressman Richard Nixon, who would later become president, raged to the press about what had happened the night before. Judith Copeland's arrest proved America's worst fears. Espionage was rampant in government. He called for an immediate response from the House Committee on Un-American Activities, HUAC, of which he was a member. As for President Truman, he silently seethed. Other members of Congress pledged to be at their desks all weekend working on new anti-communist legislation. In enthusiastic response to Nixon's demand, an emergency session of HUAC was scheduled for the evening of March 7. Its purpose to look into the Justice Department where Judith worked. And then it decided to include the Department of State before the weekend was over, responding to the claim that the United Nations were the hotbed of spying, proven by Gorbachev's arrest. HUAC determined it would investigate the entire United Nations. Washington became a madhouse, motivated by fear for American safety. Accusations were flying everywhere, fingers pointing, demands for investigation, committees springing into action.
Everyone wanted to know about the young American, the cause of it all. Writings as an editor of her school newspaper revealed Judith's strong interest in all things Russian. She complained bitterly at one point that the Allies were not doing enough to support Russia in its heroic struggle against the Nazi invaders. Why, she demanded, hadn't we opened a second front? Lend-Lease, America's pipeline of goods to Russia, also was a subject of great interest. Clues to what seemed to be an obsessive interest in Russia can be found in the mercurial fortunes of communism in America during Judith's most impressionable years. Both she and the Communist Party, by that name, celebrated their 18th birthdays in May of 1939. At the time, there was cause for celebration for both honorees, Judith's scholarship and acceptance at Barnard, and the party's then-favorable political position in the United States, one based on cooperative and commodious relations between the Communists and President Franklin Roosevelt. Ostensibly shed of its threatening revolutionary image, the Communist Party had moved into and taken over a number of legitimate and well-respected organizations, some of which were youth-oriented. But First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, a model for young American women, supported the communist-driven American Youth Congress. Of special interest to the young and to Mrs. Roosevelt was the party's advocacy of basic American ideals. In fact, from time to time, it was the most vocal movement exhibiting concern about poverty, so evident in tenements, about sexual and racial discrimination, about fairness and justice, about American youth. Along with non-communists, it railed against war and especially against fascism. There was no question that the anti-war, anti-fascist, anti-discrimination mentality which prevailed became a natural mind place for many of the nation's more thoughtful, more serious young people. It welcomed bright young students, Judith Copland among them, as explorers of its ideological premises.
Nowhere in the country was communism debated as hotly and often as sympathetically as on New York college campuses. It was into this world that Judith entered in September of 1939, when many of the most influential, most popular intellectuals of the day whom she would study were communists or sympathizers. Earlier, and from a blue-collared collective perspective, the communists avoided American intellectuals because of their annoying penchant for independent thinking and their unforgivably bourgeois background. Now, however, the communists found themselves welcoming the writers and thinkers whose words influenced American, who provided new inroads to the masses, especially to the young.
You're listening to Marcia and Tom Mitchell speaking on the Judith Copland spy case.
These were indeed exciting, stimulating, challenging times on the nation's campuses, where the brightest of the bright daily discussed politics, war, popular writers, and, of course, communism. But did an interest in and concern for Russia mean a person was a communist? Worse yet, a spy? Was being a communist tantamount to being a spy? By the time of Judith's arrest in 1949, any distinction between the two frequently escaped notice, and the terms were considered synonymous. The public already was forgetting that during Judith's college years and for a time thereafter, being a communist was both socially and politically acceptable. But 2 years after her graduation in 1945, when Judith was moving into her new job as a political analyst, the ambiance of acceptability vanished. The relationship between official Washington and the communists soured, and Americans who supported the communist cause experienced untold despair and confusion. Russia, former lover, was now the estranged enchantress. By 1948, the year Judith Copland would claim to have met Valentin Gubachev at an art exhibit, the Communist Party found itself on the legal defensive with the indictment of 12 members of its national board. They were charged under the 1940 Smith Act prohibiting conspiracy to overthrow the U.S. government by force or violence.
Valentin Gubachev came to the United States in 1946 as a member of Russia's UN delegation. He subsequently worked as an engineer on the UN building, but still after his arrest claimed to have diplomatic immunity and thus not subject to arrest. An enormous legal brouhaha between Russia and the United States began immediately and continued to the highest level. Meanwhile, the Department of Justice was under intense pressure to get on with the spy case, which had so taken over the news. Within 2 weeks of the initial arrest, the government decided to arrest Judith a second time, but in Washington, on essentially duplicative charges. What made it possible for the government to avoid the issue of double jeopardy was that the two-count indictment in Washington was against Judith alone and concerned her removal of files from her office with the intent to give them to a foreign nation. The four counts she already faced in New York included conspiracy charges against both Copland and Gubachev. The new indictment allowed the government to move ahead quickly with a trial they expected to last no more than 5 days, unencumbered by the sticky issue of Gubachev's diplomatic immunity claim. Shortly before the Washington trial began in April of 1949, Judith's family hired a madcap, irrepressible bankruptcy lawyer to represent her in one of the nation's most controversial criminal cases. Totally inexperienced for the job, Archie Parman nevertheless used his talents to take command of the government's case and to make a mockery of the prosecution and the FBI. The elderly, semi-retired judge was bewildered by it all, bamboozled by a pear-shaped 5-foot-3-inch clown who turned the courtroom into a circus.
The contents of Judith's purse the night of March 4th became the government's sole evidence against her. Prosecutors said her possession of various memoranda, notes, and excerpts from FBI reports proved her intent to pass them to a foreign nation to the benefit of that nation and to the detriment of her own. But Judith offered other explanations for having the materials with her. She was about to take a civil service examination based on them and had them with her for study purposes. Or she was writing a novel about her work as a government girl. But it was not the evidence in Judith's purse that set the courtroom on its ear. It was what that evidence led to, the secret FBI files on which the Bureau excerpts were based.
Archie Palmer insisted that if the FBI excerpts found on Judith were admitted into evidence, then the entire Bureau file on which the excerpts were based had to be admitted. This was his client's right. No one on the government side believed the judge would decide in favor of the defense. Prosecutors insisted that in the name of national security, it was unthinkable that the most secret of secret information should be released to the public. National security, they said, must prevail over the rights of a single individual. But to the total amazement of a waiting world, the judge issued one of the country's most profound courtroom decisions. If the government cannot present an honest case, elderly Judge Reeves said, it should not be in the courtroom.
For days, the government files were read aloud, files called raw, because they contained both fact and unverified rumor and conjecture. Popular film stars were accused of being communists. The most intimate details of personal lives were made public. Reports that Pentagon officers might be attending sex parties nearby, and details of international intrigue and clandestine love affairs were covered at unheard-of length in the news. The Copland case became the nation's number one soap opera, and Judith became its star. Autograph seekers and photographers hounded her. One young man mentioned in the secret files committed suicide over the exposure. It was widely rumored that J. Edgar Hoover would resign over the Bureau's embarrassment. The president was furious. Throughout the 10-week trial, Archie Palmer had questioned FBI agents, more than a dozen of them, about wiretapping. The response was always the same. I have no knowledge of it. Even Prosecutor Kelly was asked if he had knowledge of tapping. Furious, outraged, he demanded that the judge ordered Palmer to quit asking the same question.
Judith had claimed all along that her meetings with Gorbachev, three of them a part of the case, were based on love, not espionage. The country awaited her appearance on the stand with a collective bated breath. In her testimony, both direct and cross, she fervently proclaimed her love for Gorbachev. It was this that brought her down. Chief Prosecutor John Kelly, who had just won a treason conviction against Axis Sally, demanded of Judith, "Isn't it true, Miss Copland, that you and Gorbachev never were in love whatsoever in the slightest degree?"
Judith protested. Of course she was in love. But Kelly delivered the fatal blow, evidence of an affair with a young Justice Department lawyer. This was 1949. Nice young women were at home having babies, not affairs. It was inconceivable to most, including the jury, that a nice girl would love one man and have an affair with another. It was different for a man. A friend who was there at the time was told by a juror that any woman who would lie about love would lie about spying.
Judith was convicted of the charges against her on June 30 and sentenced the following day to 10 years in prison. She was allowed to remain out on bond until her New York trial was over. Palmer appealed Judith's conviction to the First Circuit Court. It was during the New York pretrial hearing 6 months later that the magnitude of the government's mistakes in this case came to light. Robert Granville and Agent Arthur Avignon both admitted knowledge of wiretapping. In fact, it turned out, her agents had even listened in on conversations between Judith and her attorney, and, incredibly, during the course of the Washington trial. The government was flabbergasted. Not only had these things happened, but agents had lied on the stand.
FBI special agent, the late Robert Lamphere, the man who orchestrated the Bureau's case against Copland, told us that agents had been instructed to claim no knowledge of tapping by none other than government prosecutor John Kelly. As for the Bureau, Hoover insisted that tapping had been done with official approval of the Attorney General, who, in turn, insisted he had such authority. But Congress said he had not, that he had bypassed a law precluding tapping. The taps were declared illegal, and the government would need to prove, in the second trial, that all information about the case came to them by means independent of tapping. Further government misdeeds came to light, including destruction of wiretap notes and of the actual recordings. At first, agents insisted that destruction of the records was a matter of routine, but this was not so.
In the course of our research, we came upon the original type memorandum ordering the destruction of the records and noting that the memorandum was to be destroyed after being read. Someone failed to do so, and the memorandum survived. At the lower left on the taped and tattered page, I recognized Hoover's initial approval of the destruction. It was the same that had appeared as approval of recommendations on memoranda I had written to him. Pre-trial hearings, expected to last less than a week, continued for months, hopelessly bogged down by these issues based on the government's questionable behavior in the name of national security. Finally, the court decided to go ahead with the New York trial, basing its decision on government testimony that nothing learned about the case had come solely from the illegal taps. The hearings judge, however, severely scolded the government for its unlawful activities.
By this time, it was believed that the historic Cold War case that had created so much interest, publicity, and controversy would move quietly and quickly through the New York trial, which finally began in January of 1950. But it did not. Midway through the course of events, Judith fired Archie, who had become nearly impossible with his dramatics and unpredictable behavior. Three new attorneys were appointed by the court to defend Judith. They asked the court for 60 days to review the more than 8,000 pages of Washington trial transcript, hundreds of motions, and the evidence, and to prepare for trial. The judge incredibly gave them 1 week to do an impossible task. As a result, the lawyers refused to defend. Oh, they appeared in court every day, but never examined a witness, never made a motion. The defendant was left defenseless. No one spoke on her behalf. To no one's surprise, Judith was again convicted, as was Gubachev. To everyone's surprise, Judith was acquitted of having attempted to pass secrets to the Russian, who was convicted of having attempted to receive the very same secrets. There were other contradictions. The jury's decision, rendered early in March, made absolutely no sense, but it stood.
Judith was sentenced to 15 years in prison. Gubachev received the same. But because of a secret agreement between the president and Russia made a year earlier, he was allowed to return home. That agreement on file in the New York archives reveals the reason for the deal. Had the Russian been deported immediately after his arrest, the government feared, the American public might feel sorry for Judith Copeland, a woman left alone to face charges. Appeals were heard on both convictions. As in everything with regard to this case, the results were controversial. One court found the arrest illegal. Another found it legal. One court overturned Judith's conviction. The other did not. There was one consistency. Both courts left the indictments open. The Washington Appellate Court, which confirmed the conviction, ordered that if evidence existed of wiretapping of Judith and her counsel, she deserved a new trial.
There never was a new trial, in spite of the evidence of tapping privileged conversations. The case remained active, totally tangled legally. The Supreme Court refused to hear appeals filed by both sides. Judith remained out on bond for 18 years after her arrest until Attorney General Ramsey Clark vacated the indictments in 1967. Judith married one of her appellate lawyers, raised four fine children, and has led an exemplary life as a model and contributing member of society.
You've been listening to Marcia and Tom Mitchell speaking on the Judith Copeland spy case.